Okay, right. Good evening, everybody. It is lovely to be here with you. As you just heard, my name is Zoe. I am your host for the evening. Welcome to the Variety Night. I hope you're all having a fantastic day, a fantastic weekend at EMF. It's just going to get better. The day is going to get even better because I've got an absolutely jam-packed show for you, full of fantastic speakers. We've got things from space magic to a mathematically themed musical. It is all to come. But actually, before you find out a little bit more about our speakers and about me, I'd like to know a little bit more about you and who we've got in tonight. So we're going to do a little survey, right? I imagine some of you know how this works. I will say a thing. If that thing applies to you, you give a whoop, you give a cheer, and we'll see which thing gets the loudest cheer, sort of, verbal bar chart situation going on. That's what's going to happen. I can't see any of you, so you're going to have to be extra loud so that I know. Oh, there's so many of you. Fantastic. And you know, actually, first fun fact of the evening, there is one tent for every 48 attendees across the EMF camp, I've been reliably told by the EMF team, and there are more than 48 of you in here, so we're doing better than expected. So I'm loving it. It's great. So we'll do our first whoop. So whoop, please, if this is your very first EMF camp. That's quite a lot of whoops. I'd say that feels like about half of you, maybe slightly fewer than half. Let's try the other side. So give me a whoop if this is not your first EMF camp. That's louder, whether it's louder or just, I think there's probably more of you or you're just more enthusiastic, I'm not sure. We'll see. Let's drill down into this a little bit. So actually, give me a whoop if this is at least your third EMF camp. Ooh, excellent. Give me a whoop if this is at least your fifth EMF camp. Wow, hardcore. Give me a whoop if this is your seventh EMF camp. Fewer, but enthusiastic. So that's our second fact of the evening. I've been told seven EMF camps. This is our seventh. Very exciting. I've been given other numerical facts to drop in throughout the evening, which is appropriate because I'm a mathematician. But actually, my main job tonight, of course, is being your host, which is, I guess, it's kind of glorified stage admin. You'll see me introducing speakers, and I will be just generally making sure that everything is running smoothly, that people are having a good time. You all appear to be, which is fantastic. But I think before I introduce you to our first speaker, I will do my own little bit of stuff. I'll tell you about something that I've been excited about recently, which is baby names. So I've been really into, and if I could have my slides on, so I've been really into baby names. For a little while, I've been interested in names, and I tend to notice patterns in names that other people don't seem to spot. And a little while ago, some friends of ours had twins who they named Eleanor and Leo. And when they gave us the good news, the first thing I said to them was, "Wow, one of your children is a subset of the other." Apparently, congratulations is traditional. But as somebody who really loves names, I've spent a long time kind of poring over the details of the ONS baby names database. And so they've been collecting this data since 1996, and they record any names that were given to three or more babies in that year. And if you have a look at the top names in each year, we notice something really interesting. So I made this chart, which shows the number of babies given each of the top names in any given year. So this is 2020. That data was released just a week and a half ago. Some people might have noticed that in the news. We noticed two really interesting things. So we can see that the top girl name was given to far fewer babies than the top boy name in every year. And it seems that parents kind of choose more unusual names for their girls, and there are far more girls' names recorded, I guess, for them to choose from. And the second thing we notice is that as the years go on, fewer and fewer babies are being given those top names. And this is because we are having fewer babies, but also because we're becoming more adventurous with the names that we give our babies. So far more names were registered in 2025 than back in 1996. And as a result of these two trends, we have got disproportionately huge numbers of babies given the top boy names in the late 90s, or the top boy's name in the late 90s. So in 96, that was Jack. In 97, it was Jack. And also, it's just Jack all the way down. And then you get some other stuff as well. And actually, should we do it? Should we do another little survey? Can I have the lights up for this bit? Could you put your hand up if you were born between 1996 and 2008? So that's essentially you're an adult born 96 or later. That's quite a few people. That's quite a number of you. Fantastic. And can you keep your, let's do it. Can you keep your hand up if your name is Jack? Come on, surely. Whoa. So when my audiences are the size of Glastonbury, I'm sure I'm going to get the call up one day soon, I'm sure, then I'll tell you what will happen. We will get hands up for Jack, and the next slide will be less of a gamble, which is it going to work? There we go, jackpot, they've hit the jackpot. Never mind. So, if you're interested in trends in particular names, instead there is a specific website, this really wonderful website, by data scientist Anna Powell Smith, where you can type in any name and it will tell you kind of how that name has trended in popularity over the years. I typed the name Brittany, and I discovered this peak here. which comes 1 year after, you've guessed it, this song. Was released. And it works the other way too, right? So we can also see decreases in popularity of names at significant moments. And so this is the chart for Alexa. And I thought, well, this can't be a coincidence, right? That the name Alexa is synonymous with the Amazon Echo Assistant. But it is possible in these charts to read too much into them, as this next example shows. My name is Zoe Griffiths. That is information that you need for this slide, that you need for that joke. So my love of names took a personal turn when I had kids. So we named our first child Douglas. And at the time, I was really pleased because we bought this bath alphabet set. And I was really chuffed that we could spell it out with the alphabet set, because there are no repeat names. No repeat letters, sorry. And I was super chuffed until I got pregnant again. And I didn't want to buy another bath alphabet set. And so I realized that we needed to name the second baby with the remaining letters. So I did what you do when you've just found out you're pregnant. I wrote some code, which gave me... There we go. Which gave me all the outcomes, all the possible names that would go with Douglas. And whilst I was pregnant, we chose one of these names. But it got me really interested in how we can define a good name for that first child. Was Douglas a good name? Was that a good choice? I found a name that was definitely worse than Douglas. So Ashley Jr. There are just three options left. For what your second child can be called, they're in white. But actually, amazingly, this is not the worst name. So the worst name is Louis J, still three options, but it uses fewer letters. I thought, surely if you're going to leave your second child only three options, you want to like max out the number of letters that you're using on the first child. Best name, you've just seen it, C, apparently, tons of options. But is it the best name, really? I'm not so sure. I thought, clearly I want to have a balance between the number of options that the name gives and the number of letters in that name. So what I did to kind of explore that balance was I made a chart where every dot is a name in the database. And we've got a number of letters along horizontally, and we've got the log of the number of options that it gives vertically. And there will be some people in the audience who are upset that I am plotting doing something which is not continuous on a log chart. And just for those people, I am going to remind you that this name is C. So there are people out there doing worse things than me. and this pink one in the middle, that's Louis J, there we go, down there. And actually my code counted dashes as letters, but it's not a huge problem for the outcome. This pink one in the middle is not a name, so that is my clicker is annoyingly getting stuck. I think I have to stand in a specific position. There we go, it's gonna work. So that pink one is not a name, it's the mean number of letters and the mean number of options. That's the mean point. And the name that is closest to that mean point, so the most average name, if you've ever wanted to know, that is Bryony. I don't know if there's any Bryonies in tonight, but it's got a very average name. And so best name, so I figured it's probably going to be one of the names that's in purple at the top. So one of the ones that for the number of letters it is, gives the most possible options. So they are at the top, we've got CJ, we've got Twum, which I think is Welsh. We've got Jock, notes, not Jack, Jack is down here. We've got Bugsy, we've got Gajote, Buckley, Douglas appears here. We didn't do too badly, quite pleased with that. And we've got some sort of longer stuff over here. And I decided that I would like the name to have more than the mean average number of letters, which means that it cuts out, more than the mean average number of options, give more than the mean number, so it cuts out all of those ones. And I wanted it to have more than the mean average number of letters, so that, of course, cuts out all of these ones. And that leaves us with three options, so Gajote, Buckley, or Yitzchok. And Gajote does best relative to other names with the same number of letters, right? So that is the final answer, and that is the best name that you can give your firstborn child. You're welcome. but I realized actually that this was, it's a little bit too child-centric, right? There are some people out there, for some unknown reason, who would like to have more. And I wondered actually, what's the maximum possible number of children you could have such that you can name them all with one alphabet set, right? And I guessed that it might be eight. There are quite a lot of names that, like C, don't even use a Y. No vowels, don't even use a Y. So I thought eight might be possible. And so I wrote some code that found pairs of names that worked, and then found pairs that worked, so quads of names that worked, and then paired up those quads to find eight names that worked. And I was inspired by, lots of people will have seen this on YouTube, so Matt Parker's search for five Wordle words with distinct letters. He used a very similar method. And I wrote my code, I did some tests, and I made an estimate for how long it was going to take the code to run. That's my estimate. Crucially, this was less than 18.3 days before I needed to give a talk about it. Not good. So I did the very sensible thing of asking somebody else to write the code for me. And my friend Colin Beveridge wrote some wonderful code. And the outcome, and I'll share the code with you at the end so you can go and check it out if you want to. It's on GitHub. The outcome is not eight. The answer is not eight, in fact. The answer is nine, and there's lots of them. Amazing. And the one I found from the results that I thought was most usable was this one. So you've got some names you recognize in there as kind of real names. And the one I found that I felt was least usable was this one. But for me, this is all purely hypothetical. I'm sticking with two. And that time when I was pregnant, the name that we chose was, if it's going to work, it was the name. Here we go. It was the name. Eric, oh dear, Eric, there we go. It was the name Eric, which works lovely with Douglas on the bath, as you can see, it works perfectly. We didn't have to buy another alphabet set. And this was an absolutely fantastic plan until she was born. And at some point in the aftermath of labour, I agreed to Cariad, which is, I mean, it's a beautiful name, but it not only does it share letters with Douglas, it also has a repeat letter within it, so it falls at the first hurdle. I'm livid. I mean, she's almost three. I'm still furious. but it does explain why I call my kids Doug and Carrie, which works a little bit better. But that is enough about me. In a second, I am going to introduce our first speaker. And that's the code also if anyone wants to try and memorize that link or write it down. That's where Colin Beveridge's code is. So our next speaker, they are a mathematician. They are a ballroom dancer, I've been told. They have got a name that is almost as good as Gajote. You might be able to guess what it is. And in fact, as well as being all those things and being a fantastic speaker, our next speaker is also a highly accomplished juggler. So please welcome to the stage our next act, Colin Wright.
Thank you, Zoe. Thank you. So I do quite a lot of talks about quite a lot of things. My specialty is to find maths in unexpected places. So I used to do a talk about the mathematics of ballroom dancing. There's a surprising amount of structure in ballroom dancing. I do a talk where I calculate the distance to the moon using a stopwatch and a pendulum and more algebra than you might ever want to see in a lifetime. You get a surprisingly good answer with amazingly simple tools. And I love doing this. In my village at Equinox, I go out and I measure our latitude. I usually get it right to within 3 or 4 kilometers, which is pretty good for just sort of a stick and a string. But one of the things that happened in my past was that I was learning to juggle. Actually, I wasn't learning to juggle. I'd taken up juggling fairly seriously. I learned to juggle when I was about 14. I took it up seriously when I was at university. People do say, when did you take up juggling? The more sensible question, of course, is, why? And in my case, I took up juggling because it seemed like the obvious thing after I'd learned to ride a unicycle. And I went along to the Jugglers Club, and I said, I can do 3, but I'd like to learn how to do 5. And they laughed at me because 5 turns out to be really, really hard. Now, a lot of people, when they find out that I juggle, say, I can't even do 1. And it turns out everybody can do 1, even if you've only got 1 hand, even if you don't have any hands at all. I know a guy who has no hands, and he actually manages to juggle 1 in the standard pattern. But for the majority of people, when you've got 2 hands, there is a one-ball juggling pattern that pretty much everybody can do, and it is the standard pattern. I will come back to that in a minute. A lot of people say, I can do 2, and invariably they mean this. And if you have a look at this, if you have a go at doing this, it's a perfectly valid, a perfectly reasonable, perfectly legal way of juggling too. And if you have a go at this, you'll find that it's not that difficult. Get a couple of things you don't mind dropping. Don't use eggs. Have a go at doing this, and you'll find it's very straightforward. But I will guarantee you something. I guarantee that you will do the throwing with your good hand. Now, that catches people by surprise. Actually, it doesn't, because nobody notices. But it caught me by surprise, because if you don't catch the juggling ball, then the juggling does not last for very long. Critically important that you catch the juggling ball. But if catching was the most important thing, then logic dictates you would use your good hand for it to make life easier. But you don't. You use your good hand for the throw. And that's because it's only the throw that matters. If the throw is perfect, the catch takes care of itself. All you have to do is have your hand in more or less the right place. If you use good juggling balls, more about that if you catch me later and ask me about it. And you don't have to trust me. You can learn to juggle too like this, and then find somewhere nice and quiet where nobody's watching. Don't do this in front of your friends, if you have any friends. sorry, personal experience. Oh, you laugh. Thank you so much. Lots of audiences go, oh. Not sure about you. Okay, so have a go at doing this, and then make sure nobody's watching. Try and do it the other way. And you'll find that throwing with your not-so-good hand is phenomenally difficult. And that's where almost everybody gives up. But if you persist, you'll be able to do this throwing with the not-so-good hand. You can still do it throwing with the good hand. That doesn't get broken. So then you can swap between them whenever you want. And you can keep swapping between them whenever you want. And if you can do this sort of thing, you are moments away from juggling 3, but not in that cyclic pattern, because juggling 3 in the cyclic pattern is really, really hard. Right? If you watch my hands, they are moving faster than is humanly possible, which tells you I am an alien. But the second thing it tells you is this is really hard. There's a much easier way of juggling 3. Very, very quickly I'll go through this. Pick up 3 balls. Unless you're exceptionally gifted, you cannot hold 1 in each hand. So throw 1 away and hold on to the other 2 and keep doing that. Always throw 1 into the air and hang on to the other 2. And that gives you three, and then after a while that gets boring, so you bring it down and widen it out, and you end up with this. Now, if you watch one of the balls, I like that one. If you watch the balls, you see, sorry, some of you missed it. There it is again. Watch the balls. You'll see it goes up in the middle, down the outside, up in the middle, down the outside, up in the middle, down the outside, up in the outside. Unless it goes up on the outside, down the middle, up on the outside, down the middle. Unless it does something completely different. But the thing is that if you juggle three balls and all of the throws are the same, then they will be three beats between throws, fairly obviously. If you juggle four balls and all the throws are the same, it will be four beats between throws. So that means that when you throw that ball, you'll next throw it four beats later. And if your hands alternate, one, two, three, four, 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 one, two, three, four. That means that the balls have to stay in the same hands. So choose a color. This will be much more interesting for you if you choose one of these colors. That's up to you. And you will notice that when I juggle four, they stay in the same hand, right? And when you juggle five, now I'm not going to be able to do this. Can we take off the spots and have the house lights on? Is that going to work? I'm not going to juggle five anyway, but let's try that. Can we take out the spots and put the house lights up? See if that works. No? Yeah, take down the spots. So nobody can see me, because that's a good thing. Right, let's have a go at five. Yeah, okay, a little bit. Let's go again. Hang on a minute, hang on a minute, hang on a minute. Look, I'm juggling 17. Right, no. And there you go, that's five. Okay, so. But the thing I want to do, and I have very, very little time to do this. So the thing I want to do is this. When I throw the balls, imagine time running that way. So when I throw the balls, juggling three, I throw each one three beats into the future, and they take it in turns like this, but I don't have to. I can throw this ball further into the future. I could throw it three into the future, or four, or five. What would you like? Four or five into the future? Who wants four? Five. Why am I not surprised? One, two, three, four, five. Now that leaves two gaps. Where do you want this one to go? Two, three, or five?
Five.
Five? It's not going to be very interesting. I like two, but okay, let's do five. I'll tell you what, with this one, let's do one. And then let's do one. And now I have three in a row again. So then I can go back to doing three. And if you do a five, five, well, what's a one? Well, a one means I have to throw this every time I throw a ball. So that means I throw it from this end and I throw it from this end, that side, that side. This is juggling one ball in the standard pattern. So if I do five, five, one, one, it ends up looking like this. Now, I have no idea if I'm going to be able to do this staring into the spots, but I've got to do five, five, one, one. So what I've got to do is five and five, one, one, and then go back to juggling three as if nothing had happened. So let's try this. I'm going to start with this ball from that hand next time round, and we get five, five, one, one. And that is the juggling trick that you asked for. So in my remaining 1 minute, I'll show you what happens if you do a five. One, two, three, four, five. And then you do a two. And then you do a four. And then you do a one. Five, two, 4-1, 5-2-4-1, 5-2, I just have to hold it, 4-1. Okay, let's see if we can get this going. So we get, starting with the orange ball from that hand this time around, so we get 5-2-4-1. Now, you saw me hold up the ball? Let me do it again, starting with the orange ball from this hand, let's have a go at this, and we get 5-2-4-1. Let's try and do it constantly. Here we go. Let's go. 5-2-4-1, 5-2-4-1, 5-2-4-1, 5-2-4-1. Look at the green ball. It's always green. But why is it the same ball? It's the same ball because that's the ball that's being thrown four beats into the future, and the pattern repeats every four beats. And by using this kind of way of analyzing juggling tricks, we found juggling tricks that had never been done before. And they have been taken by the Gandini Juggling Project and actually performed on stage in Akhenaten the Opera and other places. We've actually had people take those technical patterns and turn them into something beautiful. And it's the combination of skill, maths, art, and performance. And those things combined can be amazing. And I hope you've enjoyed that very small taste of it. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Colin. That was wonderful. He kind of puts me to shame a bit. I'm struggling to hold a flip chart and a microphone and a clicker and talk at the same time. I find that quite stressful. And he's juggling and talking at the same time. From behind stage, if you're not watching him juggling, it's essentially him saying 5, 4, 2, 1 lots and lots of times, which is it's better when you can see him juggling. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Colin. So our next speaker, his name is only 2 letters different from Colin, 5 letters as well. Actually, 2 letters different, but quite kind of half the number of options this name gives. You know, wow, amazing. Who would have thought it? He's a cardiologist. He is a YouTuber. And he is here to help us kind of navigate the world of medical jargon. Please welcome to the stage Rohin Francis. Laptops and Rohin. Lots of you are into tech, right? So you love watching people put HDMI cables out of one laptop and into another one. I'm sure that's what you're here to see. Actually, one fun fact that somebody backstage just reminded me of is that the number of bathtubs that have been filled, like effectively, would be filled with the amount of milk that the EMF camp have used is 5. Which is just, it's just why. I mean, number of bathtubs filled with water used by people washing who are camping, 0. I'm joking, I'm kidding. I think Rohin might be ready. We are not ready. We've got a tech person coming on stage to fix things. One of my jobs is not fixing tech, which I'm quite pleased about, because you wouldn't want that. So Rohin's gonna make this thing work. I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure you have been washing, everybody, a little bit at least. So another fun fact that I should give you, I was going to save this for a quiz later on, but we can do it, we can go with it, which is the number of square meters. Is it in square meters? What unit are we using? What did we use, Katie? Shall I check? It's not square meters. The amount of flooring across the whole site. Do you want to make a guess in your head? Use any unit you like, and we'll see if you're right. 1 acre. You might have been right. I think Rohin is now ready, so take it away, Rohin Francis.
Hi, everybody. Juggling's a tough act to follow, isn't it? Hi, everyone. My name's Rohin. It's great to be back at EMF. It's my second time here. It truly is the event where I can use my nerdiest material. I'm going to start a bit topical, if that's okay, because I'm sure a lot of you are aware that Count Binface is battling it out with Nigel Farage in Clacton, for Clacton. Now, I didn't know much about Clacton, so I did a bit of research, and it's actually, I'm a doctor, so it, you know, it's got some really terrible health outcomes in Clacton, really, really bad health. This is a map of cardiovascular disease in Clacton. It's in that dark region there. It's a real black spot for cardiovascular health, and I was trying to figure out why, and I went to look, do a bit more research, and I found out, I think you need look no further than the man in charge of cardiovascular care for the region, and I was surprised as you, but that's me. now that the introduction's out of the way, I'm actually here to talk about language and words that doctors use, because obviously we're renowned for being clear communicators. Ha ha ha, it's very funny. No, stop laughing. This should not be a joke, okay? If you leave with one message today, this is unacceptable. Doctors who cannot write legibly should be suspended from practice and sent to forced re-education camps, or gulags, as the wokerati want us to call them, where they are taught to write legibly like children. And if they can't, then cast them out into the medical dungeons with the chiropractors and the homeopaths, and people who sell supplements on Instagram. Medical dungeons is actually manifesto point number one when I run as health secretary in Count Binface's new government. I'll call myself Baron Clinical Wasteface. And I will bring the same success that I have enjoyed in Clacton to Westminster. But yes, no, medical words. Obviously, lots of them come from Greek. So we'll start with my field, cardiology. Cardia, actually, from the Greek, the Proto-Indo-European, heard, meaning heart, and ology, of course, the study of, like nephros, kidney, nephrology, psychology, literally the study of the soul, very, very nice. Biology, the study of bisexuals. Very popular here in EMF, I've noticed. Some fields a bit less intuitive. Obstetrics obviously deals with pregnancy and childbirth. We've already heard about child names today. But obstetrics literally means the one who stands opposite, ready to receive the projectile baby. But if mother cannot generate the sufficient escape velocity and baby face plants onto the floor, the baby may be in need of an orthopedic surgeon, and literally meaning ortho, the Greek for straight, and pedia, the rearing of children. So orthopedic surgeons are literally making straight children. And just walking around today, I think they failed. Diseases. We all love diseases. Now, something you might have suspected but didn't have confirmation is, you know, doctors like to cure disease. I mean, I've got to at least say that publicly, that we cure disease. But I think it's okay if a doctor has like a little mental checklist of weird and wonderful, interesting diseases that they kind of tick off as they encounter them. I think that's fine. Doing a little dance and singing, gotta catch 'em all, on the ward round, that's unprofessional. At least I know that now, after the tribunal. But, you know, you can't really blame me. There are some fantastic disease names out there. Let's do a few of my favorite. Best disease names. The Jumping Frenchman of Maine, that's a neurological disease. Ondine's Curse, that's also neurological, to do with breathing. Toxic Megacolon, which is like a killer robot. Hungry Bone Disease. Now, that can cause a very low calcium. And you can also see a low calcium in hypoparathyroidism, which is not to be confused with pseudo-hypoparathyroidism, which is also not to be confused with pseudo-pseudo-hypoparathyroidism. Sometimes doctors are just shit posters. But my favorite is exploding head syndrome. Now, I have seen a few of these in real life. Very good. Gotta catch them all. Pica. Yes, pica is also a disorder. It's the ingestion of things that have no nutritional value, like stones or soap or paint or Greggs. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, watching Pokemon makes you eat rocks. I mean, my kids are here watching today. They're big Pokemon fans, and you've only eaten like a few pebbles today. So this is actually the first time my kids have ever seen me perform, and I'm slandering them. Now, talking of enjoying disease, anti-vaxxers have always confused me, because they like to go on about how a good steak and raw milk can cure all of life's ailments. You know, you don't need big pharma, you just need a pharma to give you these cow products. And yet, they oppose the greatest medical intervention ever made, even though it comes from the word for a cow, pertaining to a cow, vaccine. Now, the raw milk enthusiast, now raw milk is unpasteurized milk, they claim that raw milk is tastier than normal milk that we drink. And maybe they're right. I don't know, the Campylobacter and Salmonella maybe gives it a certain je ne sais quoi. But I did like this wellness enthusiast's response when I was talking about raw milk once, who said, unprocessed milk is perfectly safe as long as you boil it first. I think he might be onto something here. Now, there are some great mythological origins to words in medicine as well. Some of my favorites, the bone at the top of your spine that supports the globe of your skull is called the Atlas bone, named after the Greek titan Atlas, cursed to hold up the heavens for all eternity. And the hole that articulates there at the bottom of your spine is the foramen magnum, which is Latin for big hole. So, you know, some names less imaginative than others. Now, talking of holes, the sphincter is... Sorry, that's better. So the sphincter muscle is named after the Sphinx, who would strangle her victims by squeezing around their necks. And if you ever feel a sphincter around your neck, you have gone too far. Okay, so free medical advice. Now, it's not just the names of things that I love, it's also the people. And I think it all started in school with this textbook that I had for biology, actual biology on this occasion, written by this person, V. Slaughter. But when it sat on my bookshelf, it simply said, "Slaughter living things." And that's why I went into medicine. Now, one of my great heroes was Sir Roger Bannister. I was a runner at medical school, and he obviously broke the mile, four-minute mile. Actually, the mile world record was broken again today, coincidentally. And when he died, he was also an academic neurologist. When he died, I read his obituary, and he'd edited a book called Brain's Neurology. And I thought, that's a bit of an odd name for a book. So I investigated a bit further. And this is a book on brains written by this man, Lord Brain. Now, actually, his full title is the First Baron Brain. And I feel like this is literally the only crowd where I have to clarify, I don't mean Brain Lord, the 1994 SNES volume, but no, Lord Brain wrote a book on the brain. But furthermore, I also found out that Lord Brain edited a journal called Brain. And this is a, you know, neurology journal in the UK, but not only did he edit Brain, he took over as head of Brain from Henry Head. Professor Henry Head was such a towering figure that Brain actually wrote a tribute to Head in Brain, Brain on Head in Brain. And the review of Roger Bannister's editing of the book was written by I Bone, and I'm sure he did. Now, I think it's quite interesting to compare naming practices between American and British journals, because Americans call their journals things like the American Journal of Cardiology or the Journal of the American Medical Association. Brits, we're far more no-nonsense. Our journals are called Brain, Heart, Thorax, Pituitary, Gut, and Bone. Now, there was one straggler that refused to join this trend, which was the British Journal of Urology. And for many years, I petitioned them to rename themselves Balls. But they pissed all over my idea, slowly and with an interrupted flow. They did finally agree to change their name to the much better BJUNI. Now, urology does take the biscuit, soggy or otherwise, and this is a urologist, and his name is Dick Chop. Now, you may have seen this picture because it became popular a few years ago, but I wanted to find out more about this Dick. So I went online, and you can get reviews about doctors now on Yelp alongside, you know, restaurants and foot deodorizers. And there were some really bad reviews, one-star reviews saying that he just relies on his name. But thankfully, this guy was very happy, said, of all the vasectomies I've had, Dr. Chops was the best. But finally, my very favorite nominative determinism example from medicine has to come from that esteemed journal, the British Journal of Urology, from the 1970s, an article on incontinence authored by Splat and Weedon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rowan. That was fantastic. I was enjoying that from the side. I'm a nominative determinism. I didn't know as a name lover. I was just in my element, loving it. I am glad I didn't see that talk before giving birth to Douglas or Cariad. One of the very early slides, the pediatric obstetrician. Yeah, didn't need to see that. We're going to move swiftly on to our next speaker. So our next speaker. I'm going to tell you her name. Her name is Lauren. And it turns out 28 Laurens in 2025 were born. 28 babies named Lauren, which is not very many at all. But cast your minds back to 1996, those of you who were alive. 6,303, Lawrence. Quite the change, which is, fun fact, is almost double the number of attendees at the EMF camp. So, I mean, that is a lot of Lawrence, right? So it's a lot of people, it's a lot of Lawrence. Anyway, so Lauren, she is an award-winning sci-fi author, and she is here to read us a short story. So please give a warm welcome to Lauren Bucus.
Hi, everyone. It's my first EMF. It's really exciting to be here. And I was looking for a short story to read, and I found the most EMF one I could. It's from my first novel, Moxieland. It's a cyberpunk set in Cape Town. It came out in 2008. So it's a little raw, a little punk, but we're going to go with it. And it is a very EMF story. Exhibitionist. I'm feeling fractal by the time I reach Propeller. There is already spillage out the doors, which can only be a good sign, seeing as it's just gone 6:30. But it makes me feel edgier. "You're late," Jonathan latches onto my arm at the door and swishes me in through the crowd. I can't believe how many people are here, crowded into the gallery. But of course, it's not just for me, or for my retro print photographs. I'm just gonna pause. I see there are kids in the audience. There is a bit of gore and some swearing, so please be advised. Most people are here to see Kanye and Kozy's sound installation, fresh return from her Sao Paulo show and all the resulting controversy. It's the very first time I've seen it in the flesh. The thing is gore deluxe, red and meaty, like something dead turned inside out and mangled, half collapsed in on itself with spines and ridges and fleshy strings and some kind of built-in speakers, which makes the name even more disturbing. Woof and tweet. I don't understand how it works, but it's to do with reverb and built-in resonator speakers. It's culling sounds from around us, remixing ambient audio, conversation, footsteps, glasses clinking, rustling clothing through the systems of its body, disjointed parts of it inflating like it's breathing. It's hard to hear it over the hubbub, but sometimes it's like words, almost recognizable. But mostly it's just noise. A little bit of resonance there as well. A fractured music, undercut with jarring sounds that seem to come at random. Sometimes it sounds like pain. It's an animal, right? Or alive, at any rate. Some lab-manufactured plastic biobreed with just enough brainstem to respond to input in different ways, so it's unpredictable, but not enough to feel pain, apparently. It's gratuitous, I say. She could have done it any other way. It could have looked like anything. It could have been beautiful. Like something you put in your lounge, Jonathan says. Please, Kendra, it is supposed to be revolting. It's that whole Tokyo Tech grotesque thing. Actually, it's so frickin' derivative, I can't stand it. Can we move along? I run my hand along one of the ridges and the thing quivers, but I can't determine any difference noticeable in the sounds. Do you think it gets traumatized? It's just noise, okay? You're as bad as that nut job who threw blood at her in the Joburg exhibition. It doesn't have nerve endings, okay? It does have nerve endings, but it doesn't have pain receptors. I mean, do you think it gets upset by all the attention? I mean, isn't it supposed to be able to pick up moods, reflect the vibe? Christ knows, I think that's all bullshit. But you could ask the artist. She's over there schmoozing with the money, like you should be. Woof and tweet suddenly kicks out a looped fragment of a woman's laugh, which startles me before sliding down the scale into a fuzzy electronica. See, it likes you. Don't be a jerk, Jonathan. There's a journalist who wants to interview you. It's pretty cute, by the way. My stomach spasms. This is another thing Jonathan does to keep me in my place, to make it clear that we're not together. My shrinkable tells me that I'm still in love with him. Well, actually, he didn't. He let me figure that out for myself, which cost a little more waste of time, and apparently he had the answer all along. What my psych did tell me, of his own accord, after this revelation, is that I should cut Jonathan off, get some distance, recover a sense of self. He uses a lot of shrink speak that doesn't translate and only applies to someone else's ordered life where the rules work. But it's complicated. Jonathan was the one who orchestrated this exhibition, or should I say exhibitionism, because isn't my soul being laid bare here? I know he's intending to sleep with me again. It's been really casual since we broke up, but it's still happening, even though he's seen at least two other women that I know about in between. Just, you know, fuck buddies, he says. I met the one, Mirinda, at a party, one of those awful media types, hanging off him like he was his handbag. Old bag. 38 at least. An editor at one of the push mags he works for occasionally. One of the perks of the job, fraternizing with the help. Of course, he's 32, so he's right up there with her. Closer to her than me. And was it just imagination, or did she scope me with just a shade of pity? The first time we met, I asked to take her picture. Jonathan kissed me on the head, whispering, "You cunning little fox, sweetheart. You just guaranteed yourself a publicity splash. We'll have to make the event worthy of the write-up." But I was more interested in reducing her to planes of color, the hard sculptural form of her bones. The print I went with was accidental, a misfire while I was adjusting the light settings. She is sitting on the edge of the twist of spiral stair on the fire escape outside a party. The focus is on the shapely knot of her knee, one hand resting in the dark fall of her skirt, the other touching her mouth, although you can only see the angle of her jaw tilted out of frame. It makes her look vulnerable. I glance over at my pictures, partially obscured by the swilling crowd. Only one of my prints has turned out perfect. An image that appears abstract, but on closer inspection resolves itself as an anonymous blur against the edge of a doorway, wrecked wood in the liquid swirl of graffiti, the paint still wet and dripping in runnels, so that it is all sharp, focused texture. The others have not come out so distinctly, and the gallery manager, Sanjay, is a tad uncertain about the whole shebang. The overexposed and the under, the bleached, washed out, oversaturated with color, the ones with blotches and speckles and stains like coffee cup rings, or the buttresses of white that frame the horizontal top and bottom, where the canister has cracked and let the light inside. My favorite is called Self-Portrait, a print from a decayed piece of film, 1 meter by 3.5. It came out entirely black. Jonathan propels me in the direction of Sanjay, who is standing in deep conversation with two other people. The one is clearly money, some corporati culture patron or art buyer. The other, I realize with a shock, is Kanye Nkosi. I recognize her from an interview I saw, but she is so warmly energetic, waving her hands in the air to make a point and grinning, that I can't really match her with her work. I realize I can't deal, and checking that Jonathan is intent on pushing through the queue at the bar, I detour it back towards the entrance and accidentally stand on someone's foot. "Hey, easy." "Oh, God, I'm sorry. Shit, I really, really, really need a cigarette. I wonder if I can make it to the spaza shop down the road and back before Jonathan notices." "No worries, you're the artist, right?" Yeah, well, the photographer anyway. I'm not that thing, it's not mine. Yeah, I'm Oceana, the journalist from Sonar." "Oh, right. Listen, if you want, we can talk later. I know it's your opening and you've got people to schmooze." "Actually, no, let's go ahead, let's do it." So we go outside and I catch a cigarette from a blonde familiar from other events with fucked up hair, cut ugly on purpose. So can we go ahead, get the interview out of the way? He hooks a mic into his phone and points it at my mouth. "So, what's with the old school? Didn't you read the press release?" "Let's say I didn't." I quote it from memory. "Kendra Adams' use of non-digital format is inspired by her fascination with the capacity for error." Okay, let's skip the press release. "Okay, it's just, I guess, film is more interesting than digital. There's a possibility of flaw inherent in the material. It's not readily available, so I have to get it over the net, and some of it has rotted or it's been exposed even before I load it into the camera. So I don't know that until I develop it. Like Self-Portrait. And it's not just the film, it's working without the automatic. The operator can mess up as well." "Did you mess up?" "Well, it's a great thing about working with damaged materials, you'll never know. It's the same in audio. You know, when digital was too clean when it first came out, it was antiseptic. You lost the background noise, the fidelity was too clear. But it's dead without the context. In sound, they had to adapt to digital to synth analog. You can do the same thing in photography. Apply effects, lock out the autofocus, click up for exposure, but all we're trying to do is recreate the manual. It's contentious now, though the audio techs are saying it's been nonsense all along, just nostalgia, missing the hits of the recording equipment. So it's reverted again, who knows? So you're looking for the background noise." "Yeah, or something like." I dropped the cigarette butt and twisted under my heel. "Got enough?" "Yeah, I'm good. You give a good soundbite," he says. And the gallery seems a bit less oppressive when we go back in. I'm less freaked, even when I overhear some overgroomed loft dwellers giggling into their wine. And oh my God, this, I'm so tired of statements. Like she's the only angst child to ever embrace the distorted body image. Oh, I quite like the undeveloped, because she is, you know, herself, still young, coming into herself. The artist in flux, emerges. I'm about to lean in to point out that self-portrait is meant to be damaged on purpose, but then I realize I don't have to make my motives apparent. And then I'm distracted by a flurry of activity at the door. There are people shoving, wine spilling from glasses, yelps of dismay. "Hey, this is a private function," Jonathan yells, spouting cliches at the rush of people in black who are pushing in through the crowd. Their faces are blurred like they're anonymous informants in documentary footage. It is so disturbing, it takes me a second to catch on that they're wearing smear masks, another to realize that they're carrying machetes. A few people scream, sending out a reverb chorus from Woof and Tweet, the crowd pressing backwards. But then the big guy in front of the protesters yells, "Death to corporate art!" And Emily, the woman who was dissing my art a moment ago, laughs scornfully. "Oh God, performance art, how dreadfully gauche." And there are murmurs of relief and snickers in the crowd, and the living organism that is the crowd now pushes forward again to see. Asiyama, the journalist, grabs my arm and pulls me back out of the front line because I haven't moved this whole time, just as one of the men, or woman, grabs Emily by her hair and forces her to her knees, spitting with rage. "Oh my God, don't you dare make me complicit in your garbage." One of the people raises the machete, pulling back her head by the roots of her hair, exposing her throat. She raises a hand to her mouth, pretends to stifle a yawn. "Are you gonna chop me into little itty-bitty pieces now? Please, this is so melodramatic." And it is, and the crowd is riveted. But I didn't think this kind of promo stunt would be Sanjay's thing. The man jerks her head back further, and bowing his legs, moves his arm as if to slice across her throat. Only at the last instant, so late that she winces back involuntarily, deflecting to a side swipe. Not at her, but Woof and Tweet, just in front of them. The thing emits a lean crackle of white noise. The audience is rapt, camera phones clicking. The others move in, five of them, one guarding the door, to start laying into it. It's only when the artist starts wailing that it becomes apparent that this was not part of the program. The machetes tear into the thin flesh and ribs of Kanye and Corsi's thing with a noise like somebody attacking a bicycle with an axe. It responds with a hi-hat backbeat, for the melody it assembles from the screams and skitters of nervous laughter. It doesn't die quietly, transmuting the ruckus, the frantic calls to the police, and Kanye the artist wailing, clawing, held back by a throng of people. The bright sprays of blood make it real, splattering the walls, people's faces, my photographs, as the blades thwack down again and again. The police sirens in the distance are echoed and distorted as Woof finally collapses in on itself, rattling with wet, smacking sounds. They disappear out into the streets as quickly as they came, shaking the machetes at us, threatening, "Don't follow," whooping like kids. As the sirens are closing in, one spits on the mangled corpse, and then, just before he ducks out the door and into the night, glances up once at the ceiling. No one else seems to notice, but I follow his gaze up to the security cameras, getting every angle. I'm sick with adrenaline. The woman who was taken hostage is screaming in brittle, hyperventilating gasps. Her friend is trying to wipe the blood off her face, using the hem of her dress, unaware that she has lifted it so high that she is flashing her lacy briefs. Kanye is kneeling next to the gobs of her animal construct, trying to reassemble it, smearing herself with the bloody lumps of flesh. There is a man trying to comfort the girl with the jagged blonde hair, but he is the one weeping, laid waste by the shock, while she lights cigarette after cigarette, her hands shaking. There is still a prevailing undercurrent of thrill, a rush from the violence, because no one was hurt except the thing. Everyone is on their phones, taking pictures, talking. Asiyama is shouting above the ruckus to his editor, no doubt. And there are even more people trying to wedge into the space, so that the cops, who have finally arrived, have to shove their way inside. Self-portrait, my photograph, is covered in a mist of blood. I move to wipe it clean, although I'm scared the blood will smear, will stain the paper. But just then, Jonathan takes my wrist, wraps his arms around me, and kisses my neck. "Don't ruin the effect, sweetheart," he whispers, his breath hot against my throat. "Do you know how much this is going to be worth?" I glance up at the cameras again. The beady red lights, the unblinking lenses recording everything. Already the cops are asking for the footage. Jonathan kisses my neck again and grins. "You were magnificent. Thank you."
Woo.
Give it up to Lauren Bucus. Amazing. Thank you so much. This is why we call it the Variety Nights. We've got everybody laughing at the word balls, followed by poignant literature. I love it. Quite the variety. We have, actually, before I introduce our next speaker, I should let you know that Lauren is selling some books. She's got some books here in the tent tonight, I believe, and also some over in the merch stall. So if you'd like to read more of her work, then do go and have a look at her books. Whilst we've got furniture rearrangement happening behind me, I think we'll do a little quiz. We'll do a proper quiz. So for the next fun fact, I'm going to give you three options. We're almost at the halfway mark, right? And I feel like people might need a little bit of a wriggle, a little bit of a stand-up. Yeah? So we're going to do a quiz. You're going to get three options. It's a survey again. This time you don't whoop, you stand up for the one, if you're able to and you want to, for the one that you would like to vote for. And it is for the number of earplugs that the EMF team have estimated that there are on site this year. I'm going to give you three options. Right, so my first option, and you can vote after all three, obviously. Hear all three, then vote. That's sensible. So the first option, 5,000 earplugs. Second option, 6,000 earplugs. Third option, 7,000 earplugs. Make a decision. You've got 10 seconds. You've got 5 seconds, really. We will go for stand up if you would like to go for option A, 5,000 earplugs. Everyone should take part. We've got double arm man from... It's you again. He was trolling my talk earlier on. He's back. We've got not many. Not many, I would say. I'd say 10% of you sit down. Stand up if you'd like to vote for 6,000 earplugs. That is more. That is definitely more. Half of you, I'd say. Sit down. Thank you very much. Stand up if you would like to vote for 7,000 earplugs. That feels like half as well. Oh, I'm the mathematician, apparently. Right, so if you sit yourselves down, I think, that was really tricky. That was very, very difficult. I'd say that was marginally 6,000 earplugs as the most popular answer. The answer, 5,000 earplugs. So well done. Well done, double arm man. Well done, the minority. Anyway, without further ado, I think we're almost ready for our next speaker. So our next speaker, when I looked on my file to find out how many babies were born with his name, Excel told me it was 34 in 2025. Just 34, so not very many at all. But unlike his name, our next speaker is very popular, as you will discover in a second. He's one of our favorites. He is a space scientist, he is a magician, and he is here to combine both of those things to show us some space science. So please give a warm welcome to Neil Montero.
Thank you. Zoe, just hold on there a minute, Zoe, because I'm going to need you. Yeah, just stay there 1 second. So, first of all, an admission. I agreed to do this, I think, several months ago. It's one of those things where someone says, hey, do you want to do the Variety Night EMF? And I was like, yeah, that sounds fun. 10 minutes, how hard can it be? And then about a week ago, I was like, oh, I'm doing the Variety Night EMF. What should I do? And then I noticed that they billed me as a space scientist and magician, and I'm afraid only about 25% of that is actually true. So you might be wondering which 25%. Well, it's not the scientist bit. So I'm actually a space engineer, which might sound really picky. But if you're a space engineer, you make stuff that goes to space. And if you're a space scientist, you understand the stuff that's happening in space. So, you know, there's one problem. The other bit that I'm definitely not is a magician. What actually happened here, I think, is there's been a big misunderstanding for a while that I once worked as a magician. And when I say once, I mean a single gig. And you might be wondering what happened on that gig that meant that it only happened once. I can tell you it involved balloon animals, but let's not go any further into it. But then I somehow managed to get a reputation for being both some space stuff and a magician. So I'm going to do my best to show you a space science magic trick that doesn't involve any real magic, but definitely involves some space science, even though I'm really an engineer and not a scientist. So it's going to go great. So first of all, I needed a card, and I think the quickest way is, Joey, would you mind coming back up? I warned Zoe that I might ask her to do this, but she doesn't know anything else. Bearing in mind, I'm not a magician. Right, Zoe, come over here. I've got something set up. Let's just I'm hoping that this camera will work, because it worked mostly, as usual, it works really well until I need it to work, and then it does absolutely nothing. Is it coming on now? Oh, that's brilliant. That worked fantastically all through the rehearsal and the test that we did, and then absolutely zero at this stage. Let me just see if that's actually coming on at this point. It's on. If anyone's going to solve my problem, surely it's an audience at EMF. I'm using AirPlay to get my camera up. Any ideas as to why it's not working?
Have you tried turning it off
and on again? Yeah, okay. I saw that one coming, yeah. I might have to try and reconnect this. 1 second. Come on, why are you being so difficult with me?
Should we give Neil a bit of time to fix the camera situation? As I might have mentioned earlier, I'm not here to fix the tech. Yeah, so I'm hoping that someone with much more knowledge than me will come and give Neil a hand, because I'm definitely not that person. But I do have some more fun facts for you. We could do another little vote if we're feeling sort of ready for that. And this time it is for the number of chairs on site per attendee. Right, so number of chairs on site per attendee. I am going to give you three options. I'm wondering how bad the tech problem is. Do we have time for stand up and sit down? I think we might do. So we'll do stand up and sit down. So I'm going to give you three options. You get to choose stand up for the one you want. So we'll go for option one, is there is 0.9 chairs per attendee, which feels like not quite enough. Option two, but it could be correct. Option two is there is exactly one chair per attendee, and option three is there is 1.2 chairs per attendee. So make your decisions. Stand up if you would like to go for option A, which is 0.9. I'm eating into your set, I'm sorry, Neil. 0.9, so that is about a third. If you sit down, option B, which is one chair per attendee. I can literally count you. There's like 16 of you. Okay, sit down. Stand up for option C, which is 1.2 chairs per attendee. That's almost everybody. You know what? You're all correct. Well done. Welcome back, Neil.
Babe. Okay, whoever said turn it off and on again, you are a genius. I'm not a magician. This is where we left it, right? Not a magician. Not going to do anything fancy with this. We're going to do a simple technique to pick a random card. I want you to go down the deck like this. Go less than halfway, or at least halfway, or something around that. Pick it, yeah. Take it up, turn it upside down, and put it back on top again.
Turn it upside down
is fine, because this is not the one we're going to pick. What we're going to do is we're going to randomize it by doing it again, but this time go a bit further. Go down, turn it over, pick it up. Okay, cool. So now what you've got is a bunch of cards. Some of them are upside down, some of them are not. And the one where it stops is going to be the card that you've reached. Okay, so don't show me that card, all right? Keep that one to yourself. Let's just put these out of the way. So what we want to do is just have a look. Here I have a box. Thank you. This is designed to keep everything secret. Inside the box is, I put this together at a very short notice. So inside the box, not a head, inside the box is a card and a thing. What I want you to do is to swap your card for this one and put it back in the box so it's facing this way. Okay? So I have to do this in a way that I can't see what's happening. When you're done, you'll have to just slide the lid back on as well. The audience can see on the camera as you put it in, right? So if you don't, it's a good to remind you. I've been not a magician, right? It's really obvious now. So yes, maybe you should show the audience too. That's a good idea. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to cover my eyes up while you do that. And then when you're done, you let me know, because then there's no way I can know what the card is. Okay, right. Here we go. In your own time. By the way, this is just the one I happen to have with me. Yeah, that's also just something that I found randomly on my way out of the house today. Okay. Of course, at this point, I'm just standing on a stage with a blindfold on, which does leave me quite vulnerable at this point. That would be a good joke, wouldn't it? I open my eyes and there's no one left in the audience.
I'm done, Neil. I'm done.
You're done. Okay, right. I'm going to take the blindfold off. Is that okay? Okay. So the blindfold is off. The card is in there. I don't know what the card is. What card is that?
That's the one that was in there.
Oh, that's the one that was there already. Okay, phew. Because otherwise the whole thing's not going to work at all.
Shall I leave you to it?
You can leave me to it. You can stay on. I mean, I haven't got anything else for you to do, but you're welcome to stay.
I know, I'm stuck down there, but
okay. I like to be very inclusive, at least anyway. But yes. So. Now, that is the magic part of this trick, right? And the space science bit is going to come courtesy of this man called William Herschel. So some of you may know William Herschel as the discoverer of, is it Uranus? Again, not a space scientist, right? I think it's Uranus. If we haven't sent a spacecraft there, I wouldn't know. But I think it is. So he discovered it famously, I think, in Bath, in a garden there. But he's also famous for something else. He discovered the use of infrared astronomy, or rather infrared light to begin with. So he had a prism, and I guess most of you know this, you have a prism and some light comes in, and then it makes a nice pretty rainbow. And what William Herschel did was he made his rainbow and then got a thermometer and moved the thermometer around on the rainbow. And what he noticed was that if he went all the way to the red, he got a certain temperature, but if he went past the red, the thermometer got hotter. So there was obviously something there that he just couldn't see. And this is what we know as infrared. And infrared is very valuable in astronomy because it shows you what something looks like in a color that you can't normally see. And you'll get sort of information, structures that aren't normally visible. The best example that I have of that is the Crab Nebula. Crab Nebula is a star that exploded about 1,000 years ago, and we know that happened because it was quite a bright explosion, and everybody in their diaries wrote, wow, massive explosion in the sky today, it was cool. So we can trace it back to a certain date. If you look at it with a telescope on the Earth, you'll actually be able to see it. You get like it's a fuzzy blob, but it's there. What we typically do with telescopes that we want to get really good images is that we want them above all the atmosphere. And with infrared, that's very important because the infrared is absorbed by all of the water in the sky. So this next picture is not in infrared, it's in just regular colors, but it's taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. It gives you an idea of what this really looks like. So that is the Crab Nebula when viewed from a good vantage point, you see what's going on. So that is an exploding star. And we say exploding because stars take a really long time to explode. Now, you may have heard of the James Webb Space Telescope. So that's kind of the successor to Hubble. That was launched about 3 years ago and has been slowly taking pictures that just basically improve on what Hubble did. And it also has an infrared camera on it. And here's the picture that James Webb Space Telescope took with the infrared camera. And it's subtly different. It can be a little hard to see from this exactly what's different. So I'm just going to overlay them and then just fade out the Hubble image. And that's the James Webb one. I'll just fade it back in so you can see it again. So you're just picking up on slightly different structures. And what it's doing is it's actually allowing you to see through some of the dust cloud that gets kind of in the way in the optical image. And we can get rid of it and look through into something else. And this is where our little secret comes in. So we're going to do some infrared astronomy right now. So this is a non-magic trick. I have to point it at all of you just because I need a bright source, and you're all very, very bright. So what I've got here is an infrared filter that's normally used for regular infrared photography. If you've done any sort of 35mm photography, you might have seen one of these. It cuts out all the normal colors and only lets through a very narrow band of infrared. And I always thought you had to have a special camera for this, but it turns out smartphone cameras are a bit rubbish at filtering out infrared. Now, that is not that impressive, I agree. Because what we're looking at there is this room in infrared. And what I didn't think about when I started planning for this day was that it was going to be about 10 o'clock by the time I stood on the stage, and the sun would have gone down, and there'd be no infrared light anywhere. So what I brought with me as a sort of backup was this infrared floodlight from a CCTV camera. And while it might not be very obvious what's going on here, I'm just going to point the camera at the box. And this is how you do a magic trick with no magic. Oh, I say it very impressively. Is it actually going to work? This would have been much better had I actually had a chance to try it. And there is the four of spades. Sorry, was it the four of spades that you had? Of course it was, because how else would it be in the back? So I'll leave you with one more thing, though, because I obviously this is not real magic, and then we did say we would do magic. So for one little final thing to to leave you thinking about, there is one more chance to actually do some infrared magic here, and I've really got to hope that this works. Let me just, should have prepped this slightly better earlier, but one more thing for you to think about as I leave the stage is, where are we? I'm over here. This did not work anywhere near as brightly as I wanted to, but if I'm lucky, it will show up there on my t-shirt. And with that mystery, I will leave you. Thank you very much. Good night.
Okay, big round of cheers again from Neil Montero. Fantastic stuff. Thank you very much. Okay. That was lovely. Lovely stuff. We're going to have a little bit of furniture changing behind me again and some tech changes and so on. So I think it's probably an appropriate point for our third and, I'm not going to say final, but we're going to do one last little vote and then we'll move on to the next person. So my final fun fact. Here we go. Right, so you get three options again. It is about the number of potatoes used in the volunteer kitchen, so the amount of potatoes used in the volunteer kitchen. I'm going to give you option A, which is a quarter of a ton of potatoes used in the volunteer kitchen, half a ton of potatoes, that's our second option, or three quarters of a ton of potato used in the volunteer kitchen. Have a quick think about how many volunteers there are. Have a quick little decide in your head. Some discussion going on. We'll go for, stand up if you would like to go for A, which is a quarter of a ton of potatoes. Option A. Not many, but you're probably getting tired of standing up, which is understandable. We're not going to do this again. Right, so option B, half a ton of potatoes. A bit more, wow, that's a lot. That's a lot of you. That's more than half. Sit down, and option C, three quarters of a ton of potatoes. The clue is that I hesitated before I said it because I couldn't remember what I'd made up. So that is not the correct answer. In fact, you overestimated most of you. It is a quarter. It's a quarter of a ton of potatoes. There we go. Still a lot of potatoes. I think that's that's all we need to know. It was a lot of potatoes. That's the answer. All right. So our next speaker. Describes himself as the world's number one ZX Spectrum rock star. And when I put his name into my spreadsheet, Excel told me, Microsoft Excel cannot find the data you're searching for. That is how I imagine Excel speaks. Anyway, please could you welcome to the stage Gasman.
Hello, tonight I'm going to be your musical Bob Ross. So I'm going to be creating a chiptune live on stage from scratch. It's called a chiptune because it's played by a sound chip. This chip can play three notes at once, typically square waves, which sound like this, and this is where we do the sound check. Oops. This is going to be fiddly on lectern. Okay, got that. So that's a square wave, and every 50th of a second, we send it a bunch of parameters, which things like the pitch and the volume, and that defines how it's going to sound for that slice of time. And if you stack enough of those slices together, you get music. So if we want to have a note that starts loud and dies away, then we can draw that as a graph like this, that each of these rows is 1/50th of a second, and that will sound like that. So you can hear that dying away there. So now with that in place, we can start putting our melody down. We don't use standard music notation for this because that would be far too normal. So instead, we lay the notes out on a grid like this. So again, it's time going down. So it's basically writing music on a spreadsheet. quite got that right. But, yeah, so. That's going to be bugging me if I don't fix that now. Right, so yeah, that's we've got a melody there. Hopefully you recognise it, but it's not very expressive at the moment. All the notes are just being played for exactly the same length of time. So if you want to vary that a bit, we can add a second instrument, which this time it will fade away a bit slower, something like that. Oops, that's not good. Right. But while we're at it, we can add a bit of vibrato to make this a bit more exciting. So just as we've got the volume changing over time, this column is the pitch, so we can have that going up, and then down into the negatives, 2-1, 1-2-3, 2-1, 1-2-3, 2-1. And now, hopefully, if we listen to that now, you can hear the sort of wah sort of sound there. So we can strategically drop that into our melody. And then that should sound a bit more fluid now. So now we've got our melody down in the first column. Let's, what can we add next? How about some drums? So as well as having square waves, you can also have white noise. So this works just the same way. We've got the volume dying away over time, but if we mask that out and enable the noise, that will sound like this. And we can also vary the pitch of the noise. And I know what you're all thinking, but Gasman, by definition, white noise is the absence of pitch information. Well, yes, but this is actually a digital approximation of white noise, which is determined by randomly choosing high or low levels, and the speed at which that happens determines whether it sounds like this or like this. So if we want to have it starting as a sort of hiss and turning into a crunch, then we can go something like this. And let's make that this is very fiddly on the lectern. And there we go. So if we can have this die away quickly like that. We get something that sounds sort of like a snare drum if you squint a bit. And we don't need to use white noise. Another way of getting drums is, again, if I have a note that's sort of fading away quickly, but this time if we have it do a pitch slide way down just so quickly that it loses all tonal quality, so down 100, 200, 300, and again down here. And now if you play this, you'll get a nice fat bass drum there. So with those in place, we can start adding those to our sequencer and stick these in at regular intervals just to get our four to the floor. Don't really want that to be four. And because drum parts are always really repetitive, let's copy and paste that to speed things along a bit. And this is what we get. So now how about, thank you. So I think the next thing we need is a bit of bass, and we could use a third column for that, but we've only got three to play with, and I want to hang on to that one for something else. You have to get a bit frugal here when you can only play three notes at once. Luckily, a lot of pop songs do this thing where, while the drums are playing, the bass sort of ducks out to make the drums sound more forceful, so we can do the equivalent of that by sticking the bass notes in between when the drums are playing. So. We go back to our sample there. its notes. And another bit of cut and paste. Which is all very well, but... Well, no need to applaud yet. I think we can do better than that, because those bass notes do sound a bit weedy, but we can do a bit of good old hardware abuse here, because our sound chip, it has this special feature where it can set up in advance a volume curve, and then once you set that up, it will leave it to its own devices. But that's kind of pointless, given that, as we said, we are feeding the chip new volume information every 50th of a second, and you don't really need to change volume more often than that. But what if you do? What if we tell it, well, why don't you ramp up the volume from 0 to 100% repeatedly 440 times a second? Well, what, if you're doing it that fast, then what you end up with is not so much volume control as a nice fat sawtooth wave. And even better, because that's happening on top of the note we were already playing, then we've got two waveforms modulating each other, and if the frequencies don't quite line up, then you get all sorts of lovely crunchy distortion as it goes in and out of phase. So if you start using a bit more of that, and when we play different notes, we'll have to tune that by hand, because nothing is ever easy here. I think that one works. You can start doing that, and then our good old copy and paste. And now we should have something a lot beefier. But, but it wouldn't be a proper cover of Call Me Maybe if it didn't have those string stabs, the ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba. But the problem is, those are chords, so it's three notes playing at once, and we've only got one note left to play with. But this is where we can bring in the trick that defines the chiptune sound possibly more than anything else, and that is arpeggios. This is where you take a bunch of notes and alternate between them so quickly that they sort of meld together in this sort of persistence of hearing, I guess you call it, effect. So right now we've just got a plain note with no variation. If we have that and then five semitones up, then eight, and then repeat that. Then we can get this, this sort of inverted minor chord. I think we also want a major one. So it will be 55. And with that, with those two sounds in place, we can start forming the final touches of our song. So if we go to octave three, right then. Nearly done. And there we have the final thing. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe. And all the other boys try to chase me, but here's my number, so call me maybe. I have been Gasman, thank you very much.
Fabulous stuff. Best dressed speaker of the night, so I'm loving the suit as well. Fantastic stuff. If you enjoyed that, you might enjoy in the Null sector, there's a thing you can do where you can put magnets, fridge magnets on a thing, and by which fridge magnets you choose, you sort of get to create the music yourself, so you might enjoy that too. Our next speaker also has a name which is not in the ONS baby name database, and it's not a stage name. This is her real name, and she tells me that her parents deliberately, intentionally tried to find a name that was completely unique, that no one else had, and they succeeded. She is truly one of a kind, which you will find out. She's a mathematician, she's an artist. Please welcome to the stage Aileen MacDonald.
Hello. Yes. My name is Aileen. Let me get that up because there is absolutely no way that you can hear it and know what it's spelt like. Let's go. Ooh. Are my slides gonna work? Will anyone ever know? The first one's black, so that's always a fun thing. Woohoo! There we go. So yes, this is my name. It is very close to the word alien. I did travel through space and time to be here, as did we all. Although I am dressed kind of like an alien, I'm actually just from Scotland. Oh my gosh, woos for Scotland, let's go. Yeah, my name can actually only be pronounced correctly on bagpipes. And I would love to tell you today about my all-time favorite puzzle, which is, dun, 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 the Tower of Hanoi, which, we got woos for Scotland, we got woos for Tower of Hanoi. Could there be a bear crowd? Absolutely not. Let's go. So Tower of Hanoi classically takes place on three spikes. So you've got these three spike positions, and you have various discs that you put on the spikes. And they go from larger to smaller. And the aim of the game is to move all of that tower, all of those discs, from one of the spikes to another one of the spikes. But that would be far too easy. So there are some rules. They are many, and they are thus. You can only move one disc at a time, and you may not place a larger disc on top of a smaller disc. So that's what we're working with. Those are our constraints. Let's see how this goes. Now, with maths, one of the wonderful things that you can do is you can take any puzzle, break it down, make it smaller. So let's just start off with a one-disc Tower of Hanoi. Now, you may have noticed there are no spikes for me. That's because the spikes were slowing me down too much. This is a speed Tower of Hanoi, which, I don't know if you can tell, I made it myself. So we're gonna do a one-disc Tower of Hanoi solve. Let's go. Thank you. So, one disc, one move. If you're clapping that hard for this, looking forward to what you do later. One disc, one move. Two discs, two moves? I don't know, let's find out. So that would be one, two, dun, 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 three. Two discs, three moves. Now, I can only assume that the woos are because you are recognizing that there is a sequence here. So three discs is going to take seven moves, and then I'll let you flex it. I think we all want to shout it out. Four discs, how many moves? 15. So there's a kind of like doubling the previous one and adding one on, or maybe it's close to your favorite power of two. Next one? 31. And then finally? 63, nice. So you might recognize this as the powers of 2 minus 1, 2 to the power of n minus 1. So if I were to solve all of this perfectly, that would be 63 moves. Now, you can either keep a count of the moves, totally up to you, or what I would love to bestow upon to you, EMF Festival, is a way within which you can solve the Tower of Hanoi. I don't know, not trivial. You might have noticed that I have colored the discs in alternating colors. And the reason for that is that no two of the same color should ever touch. Oh, halfway point, the big one only ever moves once. And if you keep an eye on the small disc, this wee one here, whoop, It's always going from position one to position two, and then to position three. And every second move is going to be moving this small one. So it's going one, two, three. One, two, three. And if you keep that in mind, well, thank you. Yeah. So you now, you know how to solve the Tower of Hanoi. You're just every second move, you're moving that little one, and it's going beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop. One, two, three, one, two, three. But that would be the optimal solve. And there's a really nice way of mapping this. So if you've got all of your three discs on one side, go back to a three-disc one, there's really only two moves that you can do. You can move the top one to the middle or the end. So we've got two possible moves, and we can move between those as well. Okay. Now, from any of those states, there's actually only one move that you can do. Once you've decided one of those, all you can do is move the second one to the empty slot. Okay. At this point, you might notice something that you recognize. And then if we keep going and look at all of the possible states within which this Tower of Hanoi could be, it is Sierpinski Triangle. Ooh. Yes. And this would be level six. This is the one that we're doing. This is what level six would look like. If you did an infinite amount of discs, it would look like this. Do not recommend it. It takes long enough to solve as is. But very delightfully, the solved states are in the corners. So what we're doing with the optimal solve is just running straight from the top down to one of the corners. Straight line down there. Every time you add a new layer to the Sierpinski triangle, it gets twice as tall, so that's your 2n. And it's a fence post because we're counting the moves, not the states. So that's where the minus one comes from. But why limit yourself to the optimal solve when you could self-sabotage? What about the scenic route? So this is something which I looked into recently. I asked myself, what is the maximum number of moves? I love this puzzle so much. Why would I solve it as quick as possible? Now, clearly, the answer is infinite, because I could move this one. I could just keep going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So the better question would be, what is the maximum number of moves that I can take to solve this without repeating a position that I have already visited? Okay, so for this, we would then have to think, can I go around and hit every single one of those positions without repeating myself? And the answer is yes. Yeah, I can make my way all the, here's what it would look like on level six. Very nice, very curly, yeah. And it's got this kind of recursive, because it's a fractal, the way it's solved is recursive, it has this beautiful fractal property. So we're hitting every single one of those states. We've shown that we can do that as a path. How many are there? Time for some combinatorics, let's go. Yes, so any disc, if I pick any disc, there are three, if I go from the biggest one to the smallest, there's three possible positions, and every single one of them has three possible positions. So beautifully, it is 3 to the power of n minus 1. I love that sort of balance between 2 to the n minus 1 for the optimal solve, 3 to the n minus 1 for the least optimal solve. It turns out nobody else had tried to waste their own time in such a way, which meant I recently got to add a comment on the OEIS. Yes, that has been an absolute lifelong dream of mine, but for EMF, I wanted to do something big for you. I was like, that's cool, that's nice, but I want to do something amazing because you're so cool. So I was like, what if I do a really big Tower of Hanoi? Now, my discs are all 1 inch tall, and I thought, okay, what about 58 inches? Nobody uses inches. Okay, so here's me for scale, festively crouched. It's just a little bit shorter than me, so 58 inches tall. So this is a Tower of Hanoi that you can imagine. It would be like this big. Okay, that seems fine. We can do that because you've already seen me solve a 6-disc Tower of Hanoi. That took, I don't know, a minute or so. what if I were to make it twice as big, maybe something like 14 discs? Surely that would be twice as big, so twice as long. 2 minutes? No. Oh, no, no, no. That's not how the powers of two work. Every single time you add a disc to that tower, the number of moves doubles, and so the time also doubles. You wouldn't solve a level 14. Now, you would not solve a level 14 Tower of Hanoi. But I would. So this is the Maths Village this morning. And if I were to move at one disc per second consistently for 5 solid hours, it would be solved. And I can tell you that starting at 9:25 in the morning and finishing only 5 minutes behind at 2:30, I am now the world record holder for biggest Tower of Hanoi ever solved, and it was done here at EMF. Oh! An applause so raucous that my PowerPoint absolutely crashed. Let's bring it back. I wasn't looking up Bojumon Wise Job Center. I mean, clearly I do need a bit of a job. But yeah, so EMF, I could not imagine such a nice festival. People came by whilst I was solving that, checked that I had sun cream on. People arranged different, like, there was a shade sale to try and keep me in the shadow. I'm going to seamlessly pretend that you can't see this, jump back into where we were before. And one of the coolest things that someone did was watch what I was doing and then message me afterwards with statistics. That's right, I was set upon by a random herd of data scientists managed to find me. And a wonderful person called Ari messaged me with a breakdown of my speed throughout the solve. They even did a little linear regression. At the bottom, you can see that unfortunately, nobody timed my mango juice breaks, so that's going to slow things down a little bit. I attribute that to the extra 5 minutes on the 5-hour solve. And their conclusion was surprisingly consistent. I'm going to put that on my CV. Surprisingly consistent at what? Replying to emails? No. And just in case you ever thought at some point on the program it said that I was going to solve a level 16 Tower of Hanoi, nobody ever said that. Mandela effect. No, I wouldn't promise that, because that would take an entire day to do. And if you did this, well, this is the difference between 2 to the power of n minus 1 and 3 to the power of n minus 1. One day to do a level 16, it would take a year if you did the scenic salt. Yeah, I'm not doing that. But what about the big one that I had in mind? If I wanted to solve that absolutely massive Tower of Hanoi, if I were somehow a being at the formation of Earth, so Earth is kind of like coming into its own, it's dust, it's coming together with all of this gravity, and I started solving at that point, and I kept up that consistent, as you know, I am surprisingly consistent, one disc per second, after 4.5 billion years, that would be us now, kind of like a mid-planet crisis. At that point, I would be ready to move the bottom disc. I would be at the halfway point. I would have to solve for another 4.5 billion years, so 9 billion years in total. Mind you, this thing's only this tall. And then as I place the final disc on that mediocrely sized Tower of Hanoi, the sun would use up its hydrogen supply and move into its red giant phase and engulf the Earth. But during that time, if I was such a being, there would be only one thing going on in my head, because the Tower of Hanoi comes with its own musical tune. So all I've done here, this is the optimal solve, all I've done is given each disc a musical note. In the intuitive way, the top one, the little one makes a high note, and the big one makes a low note. And this is Tower of Hanoi, the musical. It's only me that makes me do this. why. Okay. I'm going to have to go a cappella. Boom, 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 boom. Feel free to join on. Boom, 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 boom. Oh, this one's low. Boom. Boom, 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 boom.
Aileen MacDonald, everyone! Amazing! This is the end of our show. That is our final speaker. I hope that you've had a fabulous evening. I know I have. Can we just give one massive last round of applause for all of our speakers that you've seen this evening? So thank you so much for coming. I'll just finish by saying I think a number of us, somewhere between zero and the number of speakers you saw on stage, will be in the Q&A tent afterwards. So please do come along, come and ask us some questions. Otherwise, that's all we've got time for. So thank you so much for coming, and we'll see you next year. Bye-bye.